let's pick up where we left off last time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. We've been looking at a list of what Mike Mania says are some flawed foundations that show up whenever we get into debates with our atheist friends. He's listed a bunch of these, and we'll pick it up at number five.
Number five, naturalism in science. I think Mike is talking about methodological naturalism here, Bill. He says, I mentioned above that science works under an assumption of naturalism. What this means is that science has a built-in bias toward naturalism and against God and the supernatural. Professional atheist debaters will be aware of this, but we must be careful since they could still use this fact to play on the ignorance of the audience.
Mm-hmm. He's talking there about a methodological naturalism. Not that science is committed to metaphysical naturalism, the unreality of God or the supernatural, but that rather when you work as a scientist, you assume a methodology that you will only seek natural causes. Now, I don't know whether science presupposes methodological naturalism. I think that's probably up to the individual scientist whether he does that. Certainly, intelligent design theorists don't presuppose methodological naturalism, and yet I think they're doing science. So it's not clear to me that this is inherent to the scientific enterprise. But in any case, even if it is, that doesn't mean that you can't use scientific evidence to establish a premise in an argument, a premise which is religiously neutral, but goes to support a theistic conclusion. For example, a methodologically naturalistic science can support the proposition or premise that the universe began to exist, or that the fine-tuning of the universe is not due to physical necessity. Those are purely natural conclusions, and so a science committed to methodological naturalism can support those premises, and yet those premises can be significant in an argument for a conclusion having theistic significance.
I think number six here is along the same lines. He says, naturalistic assumptions confirmed. He says, atheists will often say that the success of the scientific method confirms the naturalistic assumptions of science, except that it doesn't. Supernaturalism, or belief in God, in no way implies that everything in nature has to function through supernatural means, causing the scientific method to fail often.
Right. You can't use science to support an epistemology of scientism, which says that science is our only source of knowledge and truth. So I think he's quite right in challenging that assumption.
Number seven, he says, death by lack of methodology. And he quotes an article by Barbara Forrest. He says she makes a very important point. She states that while we do have a methodology for studying the natural, we have no methodology for studying the supernatural, and this in itself should be sufficient reason to dismiss it.
Seems to me that that's presupposing the scientism that we've already rejected. I would say that the task of philosophy and metaphysics is to examine all of reality, whether natural or supernatural, and that therefore one is not hamstrung by the limits of scientism, thinking that science is our only source of knowledge and truth.
Number eight, boy, we could go to town on this one. He says, define God and define the supernatural. I have found this as well. He says, another problem that often comes up in these debates is that atheists use faulty definitions of the supernatural. They equate the supernatural with magic. How many times have you heard that? Fairy tales and overall nonsense by definition. The supernatural cannot exist because nonsense cannot exist. When it comes to God, Bill, it's often an anthropomorphic being of some kind, and with a long beard, your buddy in the sky, your sky buddy, your invisible friend, and things like that. And so defining what supernatural means and defining God could go a long way in getting rid of that. So why don't you do those?
He suggests defining God for purposes of debate as an intelligent being that is not confined to our material universe, but has the capacity to create such a universe. And that seems to me to be an acceptable concept of a kind of generic God.
Okay. And supernatural, that has fallen on hard times. That just conjures up every haunted house TV show you've ever seen and things like that. Or so supernatural just doesn't have the philosophical ring to it that it should.
In popular culture. Right. Yeah. Whereas here, he means by supernatural any phenomenon which has its basis in entities and processes that transcend the spatio-temporal realm of impersonal matter and energy described by modern science. Okay. And that's, again, I think, an acceptable and neutral definition.
All right. Let's go to number 11, just kind of skip down here. He says, tackle one point at a time. And I've heard this often, our atheist friends say, you're giving me the Gish Gallop. You list all these things that Dwayne Gish, the creationist in his debates when he was alive, he would throw out so many things that there's no way you're ever going to answer them. There was about, 50,000 things.
Yeah.
But, so he says, a good example of this is that if somebody throws 15 alleged Bible contradictions at you, said, look, we just need to pick the best 10, we'll discuss those, rather than try to spend hours on the trail.
Yes, I agree that in a debate situation, you want to limit yourself to a limited number of arguments. I typically present 5 arguments in support of theism, which involve multiple premises that can then be discussed. But you do want to have a limited number of things to argue about to keep the debate under control. Where I would disagree with him here, though, is what in the world is he arguing about Bible contradictions for? I thought this was supposed to be a debate with an atheist over whether or not God exists, and then whether or not Christian theism is true. He is allowing the atheist debater to make him pursue red herrings rather than stick to the debate topic. And that is a fundamental failure of debate strategy and technique.
You got to smell those red herrings.
Yeah,
coming.
A red herring, remember, is a smelly fish that is dragged across the path of the bloodhounds to distract them into chasing after the fish rather than their real quarry. Yeah. And similarly, to bring up Bible contradictions in a debate over the existence of God is just such a red herring.
I want to wrap up today, Bill, with number 13, because this really kind of jolted me. I realized that it's true. He says, atheism has a cult. Now, our atheist friends are not going to like this at all. But he says, whether someone belongs to an organized cult or not, there is such a thing as a cult mindset. Cult-minded people are especially difficult to reason with, and this for specific reasons. Number one, they hold a belief system that flows logically from a set of flawed foundational premises. Given those premises, their worldview is the most logical worldview, and any argument against it will naturally appear erroneous. If, however, the flawed premises are attacked directly, such persons are unlikely to actually evaluate those premises. They might consider such attacks a distraction from the real issues, or they might feel themselves superior in spirituality or intellect, and therefore not likely to be wrong on such foundational matters. And they are also heavily invested in their worldview, and change would mean a considerable disruption to their way of life. For the life of me, it never occurred to me that what can be characterized in a cult mindset is actually what I see from internet atheists, every one of those.
Yeah.
Cult mindset. Well, this gets away from debating, Bill, debating the atheist into kind of a one-on-one conversation, right? If you're having a dialogue with someone and they're just hardened in their presumptions and in their worldview, stuck in their worldview this way, you've what? Got some work to do to dig that out?
Yeah, it may be in the case of trying to win someone in a cult, that what will be more effective is becoming a genuine friend of that person, showing that person real love and concern, and not rejecting them simply because they won't accept your worldview, your Christian view. And it may be that personal touch that will help to extract them from that cult with which they identify and form their sense of self-identity and worth.
Well, Bill, I'm glad that Mike has the concern and has taken the time to interact with people online and represent his faith.
That's right. We desperately need folks who are willing to be salt and light in the world of the internet in contending for the Christian faith.